I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The American Jazz Museum welcomed a new executive director earlier this year. The position comes with a challenging to-do list, a list Rashida Phillips is ready to take on. There's a $1 million deficit the museum racked up after its 2017 Jazz Festival, a museum where too many exhibits are out of order and an image in need of an overhaul. We'll ask Phillips what her plans are to begin fixing a troubled institution. Later, meet a UMKC alumna who toured with Broadway's The Lion King. She'll recount her experiences from the road and share how time spent with the cast and crew changed her outlook on the Great White Way. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. There are tough jobs in town, and then there are really tough jobs. Rashida Phillips has one. Rashida Phillips is the new executive director of the American Jazz Museum in the 18th and Vine District. Among her issues is the need for what a consultant called a complete rethinking of the museum's purpose, a challenge not unlike starting a completely new museum. Then there's the issue of a $1 million deficit and a tarnished image following a jazz festival so elaborate that museum officials couldn't pay the bills. It's a lot to tackle, but Rashida Phillips says she's the one to do the job. She comes to Kansas City from the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago. She holds a master's degree in jazz studies from Rutgers, and she's a jazz singer herself. Rashida, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you here.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You're taking on an awfully big assignment here, as I just laid out. Why do you want the job?
Why wouldn't I want the job? You know, having that kind of background in jazz history and vocals, it's a dream job for me. I've come out of a tough situation somewhat in Chicago with the Old Town School of Folk Music. They had been around for 60 years and sort of coming into a revamping stage themselves. So it's not unusual for me to come into a turnaround situation and sort of rethink what the future will be like for these important cultural institutions.
I'm wondering what job one is at the museum. What are you aiming at first here?
Well, we certainly got to get it stabilized. I'm happy to know and meet many people out in the community, even nationally, who are really interested in this museum expanding and growing and really taking that area, 18th and Vine area, and bring it back to sort of the glory that we know it to be.
It's been a long struggle in 18th and Vine. The museum hasn't lifted the district yet. Do you see a day when that might turn around?
I hope so. I know that tourism is high on the agenda here of Kansas City with a new hotel opening, with an airport renovation coming. Certainly more and more crowds will be coming through with the draft as well in 2023. So folks have to have a place to go, and we want to make that available also for the local population too. You know, Kansas City has a rich music history. We look at other places like New Orleans, New York, even Nashville is really claiming a lot of that music scene. We've got the roots here, so we've got to get up to speed.
Do you think the city still celebrates jazz as much as it should be, given the import of that music on this town for so many years?
It seems to be quietly, right? There's certainly a number of musicians who are out in the field, and we know that there are quite a few, even on the national level, who have really given a lot of shine to their roots here. But I think we need to see ourselves anew, and I think that's what the city in general, the Super Bowl, certainly helps, you know, with our image here and getting more eyes on the Kansas City region.
You know, one of the first things that people say about a visit to the museum, and I know you've heard this many times, is that so many of the exhibits are out of order. I bet you've heard that one already. Is that still the case?
No, it's not. Actually, all of our exhibits are in working order, And we are also looking forward to some changing exhibits coming in this year and next year, providing some new experiences for our patrons.
What might people look forward to?
Well, certainly Charlie Parker is hot this year. So We are, you know, gathering each other and really thinking through programming ideas and ways to celebrate him.
The 100th anniversary of his birth.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is a centennial year. So we are, you know, hot in the fire in terms of our programming and thinking around what would be appropriate for him there. And again, having that saxophone front and center for folks to view and visit is certainly historically important.
That's the famous plastic sax that people can see when they go to the museum, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's really kind of a crown jewel of our collection.
Does the city know yet how it's going to commemorate Charlie Parker's big birthday here? I know it's being celebrated in New York and in other cities around the country. What's the plan here?
You know, I'm looking forward to planning meeting tomorrow. I've been here just shy under 3 weeks now. So every day I'm learning more and more.
You don't have every question answered here yet.
Absolutely right.
Yeah. I was struck by the consultant's recommendation from a year or two ago that the time has come, and this is what the consultant wrote, for a complete rethinking of the museum. What does a complete rethinking mean to you, Rashida?
You know, I don't think it's unusual for the cultural sector sort of to revamp themselves. The museum has been around over 20 years at this point, so it only makes sense for us to sort of dig back into our original origin and think about how we can really explore some of the newer artists as well.
You know, is expanding the museum in the mix because the museum is, on some levels, fairly small?
It is fairly small, but for a jazz museum, believe it or not, we're on the larger side.
Is that right?
That is right.
Yeah. There's been talk about blowing out the north wall over the years and adding to the museum. Is that a conversation you've had yet, or is it too early?
I've not gotten to that yet.
Yeah. How about the possibility of even shutting it down? Is that even in a remote a possibility here, given the struggles in recent years?
You know, again, that's part of what my assessment is coming in as well.
Yeah. Or even moving to a new location.
Well, you know, that area is rich. We've got a lot of institutions around us, too, that need a lot of support and need a lot of uplift as well. So 18th and Vine is really a sweet spot to be in.
Mm-hmm. One other possibility you hear about sometimes is making the focus more on Kansas City jazz, Midwestern jazz, if you will, as opposed to keeping it a national museum. What do you think of that idea?
You know, I think it's important to think of it nationally because there are a lot of territory bands that came through Kansas City and moved onward to New York and other cities or internationally. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we want to divorce that from the history in general. Certainly, it's nice to have a spotlight on our local musicians, on some of the local history.
What's the process you'll use to deal with what the future of the museum looks like? What's the road ahead look like when it comes to planning?
Yeah, right now I'm gathering the troops. I'm really working with our staff to see what's happening internally. We've got some new hires, you know, looking at our any gaps in our staffing, sort of our needs. And I'm revisiting that consultant's report along with our newer board.
Do you have a timetable in mind when you hope to begin to make some of these very big decisions?
I do not. There's some immediate changes, I think, that I'm looking into, but I certainly don't have a timeline in place quite yet.
Rashida Phillips, the new executive director of the American Jazz Museum, is my guest. The museum incurred that debt that I mentioned in the opening, coming out of the jazz festival, topping $1 million. Has that debt been paid off? Is the city requiring you to pay it off? Where does that stand?
I think we're in good financial shape from what I've seen so far. Again, I'm still digging into our records, asking more questions, and meeting around it.
But there's still, you got to figure out what to do about that debt, though. That's one of the things you got to get your arms around.
I think the debt's okay for now, but, you know, we still need to think about what our planning and what our features look like in the future in terms of live music presentation.
So the debt is still something that you feel that you owe, that you have to deal with?
Well, finances is always something that we have to keep an eye on in the museum field.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about attendance at the American Jazz Museum. Is it up? Is it down? What's the trend you've been seeing?
It's pretty neutral. This is our slower season because of the weather. We've had a couple of half-day closures and such because of the ice. So we expect the winter to be a little bit lower, but our numbers are not bad.
I mentioned the museum's image problem. That, too, apparently needs an update. How do you begin to approach that concern?
The image problem. Gosh, it's hard for me to think it has an image problem just because I'm such a jazz lover.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
you and me
for
both.
Me,
yeah.
And again, seeing that area being one of the anchor tenants there, it really, to me, is not much of an image problem. I'm just hoping that the city can get behind us as well as the public as well to come to the area. And if we can drive some tourism through there, I think that'd be excellent.
I was going to say, one of the issues that gets talked about is this idea of some people, not all, who live out in the suburbs, worry about coming down to 18th and Vine. They worry about safety issues, even though the crime record for that area is pretty good. Not many issues,
that's
even
right.
Better than some other parts of town, the Power and Light District, for instance. But how do you begin to manage that kind of situation?
I've not experienced any of that trouble so far, and I've spent some late nights there around that area. You know, it's hard coming from Chicago, right, because crime is top and center there. So far, it feels pretty safe to me. I know that we're working on some of our neighbors, again, Community Watch and some of those factors that are involved in safety. But right now, it's safe. I say come on down, enjoy the music, and celebrate.
And for the record, I do a lot and never have problems down there. You have a deep love of the music. Where did that come from in your life?
Gosh, you know, honestly, it came from high school. I know that's a big question that folks ask in the Midwest, where'd you go to high school? But for me, I was really involved in musical theater, and I had to play a jazz diva named Geneva Lee Brown in the 1940s radio hour at my junior year, and had to do a lot of research on character and songs and learning standards, and really fell deeply in love with the music.
But what is it about the music that captures, that interests you so much?
Gosh, I think it's just something about the feeling of it all, and also the social expression. You know, I'd also done a lot of research on utilizing the music to sort of see ourselves and build our communities back.
You're a jazz singer. How long have you been doing that?
Gosh, I've been doing it since the 90s.
Are we going to hear you perform down in the Blue Room sometime?
I think at some point, yeah. But I got a lot of work to do right now.
Got to get back up to speed again here,
right? That's right.
Yeah. What well-known jazz singers do you admire the most?
Well, Sarah Vaughan is the reason that I began singing in the first place.
Yeah, my mother loves Sarah Vaughan. Yeah.
Well, there's some fantastic newer singers out. Jesmia Horn is wonderful. Diane Reeves is always
wonderful
as well.
She's been to the Gem before. Yeah, I've seen her there.
That's right.
Yeah. In Chicago, before you came to Kansas City, you were working as the senior director of community ventures at the Old Town School of Folk Music. What is the Old Town School of Folk Music?
You know, it's interesting because it's a hybrid institution. Mm-hmm. You know, much like we've got over at the Jazz Museum, we've got other entities involved. The Old Town School of Folk Music is the largest community arts school in the nation. So we certainly had a big full running service there. We had a music store. We had a couple of entertainment venues. And certainly we offered music and dance lessons there as well.
And how long has it been around?
That's been around over 60 years.
What was your job there?
My job there was to expand into the future, believe it or not. With a 60-year institution, you have folks who have been there since the beginning, since its inception. And it's not just guitars and banjos that were going on there, but a lot of world music offerings. And really thinking about other communities within Chicago. If you've been to Chicago, you know it's a city of neighborhoods. And that institution was on the north side, and not much was happening on the south and west sides of the city. So my charge was ways that we could connect into other neighborhoods across the city and expand.
What was the challenge of trying to interest people in a hybrid institution? And I guess, is it an advantage for you to be coming to a museum that has a very definite focus, which is on jazz?
Yeah, well, I love the definite focus because I'm a big fan of jazz. But with folk, there was some confusion there. What folk meant
to
the community.
Yeah.
Whereas there was so much more that was happening at that particular institution.
You know, you also work for other cultural organizations in Chicago, Rashida, and I'm wondering, like, where else were you?
I was at the Chicago Children's Museum when I first moved there for about 5 or 6 years, which was an exciting institution to be at. I worked at the Associated Colleges of the Midwest, so a lot of the liberal arts schools across the Midwest. I helped with development there with professors and deans and such. And also the Chicago Arts Partnerships in Education. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of the public school systems and charter schools, we put arts integration into those schools.
You went to school, got your master's at Rutgers, kind of a renowned music program. Tell me about Rutgers. What was that experience like?
You know, Rutgers was interesting because I was on the Newark campus, so I really had a sort of a dotted line relationship to New York City. But it was one of the most diverse campuses, I think, within the country. And having the Institute of Jazz Studies was really a dream come true. So not only were we learning about the jazz music and having some performance capability to it, but digging into the archives and actually touching, you know, original material and artifacts from these greats was absolutely phenomenal.
I mean, all kinds of players come through that school to spend time with students, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Wynton Marsalis certainly showed up one day when he was doing research on Ellington connecting Mary Lou Williams to Ellington.
Mary Lou Williams, big ties to Kansas City.
Yeah, and I did a lot of deep help organizing and archiving her collection there at Rutgers.
Yeah, why isn't she better remembered today? She was tremendous.
I know, and it's so funny because doing research even in the Ellington archive at Smithsonian in D.C., you know, there's some things that he, believe it or not, he borrowed. I don't want to say ripped off from Mary Lou, but certainly heavily borrowed from Mary Lou Williams. So she's got a big foothold that people don't really know about.
You know, there's this story, and you may have heard it, from the 18th and Vine District, that the greatest jam session in the history of jazz music took place at 18th and Vine in a theater just down the street from the museum, which only has its facade still standing today. But the story is that Coleman Hawkins was battling, Lester Young and Ben Webster there, and the session went until 4 o'clock in the morning. The piano player was getting tired, so somebody went across the street and tapped on on Mary Lou Williams' window and said, hey, come on across the street. We need another piano player. And she came over and continued the jam session. And basically, Lester and Ben Webster, the story goes, drove the great Coleman Hawkins out of town in his Cadillac back over to St. Louis, I guess, that morning. You ever heard that story?
I don't know that I have.
Oh,
but
it's
I know
a great
Mary
story.
Lou, and I know she'd jump in any time.
Yeah, she did. And is part of that lore of the 18th and Vine District. You know, Duke Ellington was the focus of your thesis, which seems like such a natural for a jazz lover. What was your theme?
You know, I was looking at, he did a revusical, believe it or not, back in L.A. in the 40s. It's kind of a review and a musical. So it's called a revusical that he had done called Jump for Joy. And that's where I discovered Herb Jeffries and Ivy Anderson because they were featured singers for those productions. But it was interesting. It was a time that Duke Ellington really wanted to speak about segregation that was happening in the country, speak about politics, you know, and there were sort of little sketches and moments in between numbers and songs that he would put together. It only ran for a short time due to some threats from the Ku Klux Klan at the time and some other issues with funding.
In the history of American music, has there ever been anyone more prolific than Duke Ellington?
You know, I think I loved that he thought of himself and people gave him the title as Beyond Category, because he really kind of went beyond all that we could really imagine that maybe jazz and music in general could be. And Duke was a class act. So I think we owe a lot to Duke, along with many others who have brought the music along the way.
I mean, there's music that he wrote that he threw away and got discarded and we'll never see it again because he couldn't keep track of all the stuff he was writing.
That's right. But I think we also have to give a shout out to Billy Strayhorn, who was really right there by his side writing a lot of that music too.
For so many of those years.
That's right.
Yeah. Such a fascinating personality, Duke Ellington. He didn't reveal a lot about himself. I just can't help but wonder, what would you like to ask him, having spent as much time looking at him, if you had a few minutes with Duke Ellington?
Gosh, what would I like to ask him?
You
know, I wonder, I think a lot of people think about where these artists would be today. So I kind of wonder, being Beyond Category, you know, where he would have taken the music. Mm-hmm. And someone had asked that question on a panel about Charlie Parker when I was in New York last week at the Jazz at Lincoln Center. You know, you sort of think about, well, what would these artists be like if they were still around?
Charlie Parker, of course, dies at age 34.
That's right.
You can't believe
that's
it.
That's right. But, you know, these artists, they've given so much. It's like, I think it's up to us to really take that torch and move forward.
Yeah. Now, I love the stories about Duke Ellington. Like, he would perform at a show, the audience would leave, the other players would leave, and sometimes he would sit around noodling on the piano as people were cleaning up in the auditorium, always working on his next thing. I mean, it was just, again, his output just drops my jaw over the years.
Yeah, I mean, he's on the road most of the year, so you can only imagine how that grind was.
Boy. In working on that thesis, you got to know the Bronze Buckaroo, a man named Herb Jeffries, who was considered to be the first black singing cowboy in Hollywood, and he was the last surviving member of the 1940 Duke Ellington Orchestra. I bet he had some stories to tell.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I met Herb by chance after I completed most of my thesis, believe it or not. I'd done a program in the White House in the East Room celebrating Harlem's music and jazz music during Bush's presidency. And Herb Jeffries was the key featured vocalist for that production.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it was fun. When I met him, he had sort of a young cowgirl wife along his side and really just talked and talked and was really quite as charming and handsome as you would imagine him to be.
Wow. You know, you get me started talking about Duke Ellington and the White House. I think about 1968, President Nixon awards him the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
That's
maybe
right.
Early 69. And one of the greatest jam sessions in the history of the music took place at the White House. I've got the album at home.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the most joyous thing in the world. And you wouldn't think of Richard Nixon and Duke Ellington maybe in the same sentence, but Nixon was a huge admirer.
Well, and that's the beauty of jazz being a true American art form. I know a lot of us sort of sit back and think, oh, yeah. But, you know, that's the beauty of the music, that it always sort of transcends any of those labels and strife that we have between each other sometimes.
Yeah. How well did you get get to know Herb Jeffries and the time you had to spend with him?
You know, I was only there a couple of days, but boy, was that a rich experience. You know, he was certainly up there in age and was just really gracious the whole time.
Just out of curiosity, we're just going to play just a few seconds of some music from Herb Jeffries, The Bronze Buckaroo. This is Pennies from Heaven from the 1978 album, I Remember the Bing.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven? You'll find your fortunes falling all over town. Be sure that your umbrella is upside down. Trade them for a package of sunshine and flowers. If you want the things you love, you must have showers. So when you hear it thunder, don't run under a tree. There'll be pennies from heaven for you and me.
That's a voice.
A golden voice, right?
Boy, no kidding. What did he tell you about performing with Duke Ellington?
He just told me it was a dream come true. You know, he'd come out of those pictures as a cowboy and really sort of never thought of himself as going to that next level, and really just enjoyed the experience of being and feeling like royalty in many ways. You know, I think they struggled at that time in terms of hotels and places they could stay, but Duke always expected the best and created the best with what he had. So he said, you know, he just really felt like he had hit the top.
How much pushback did Herb Jeffries get being an African-American cowboy, traditionally a white bastion? I can't imagine what he had to experience there.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of mix on his background. He certainly had Italian. Italian was a big percentage of his background, too. So I think he was thought of a little bit as a sort of a crossover star at the time.
Yeah. So after Sarah Vaughan, after Herb Jeffries, who's on your all-time favorite performer list?
Wow. Obviously, Miles Davis, being
From
St. Louis.
Yeah.
And Miles Davis actually got his start in Eddie Randall's Blue Devils. Eddie Randall's Jr. is actually my uncle by marriage, so we have a strong connection to Miles Davis, as well as John Coltrane, who I really thought was really getting to a spiritual place with the music that I think many people have not been able to get to.
Somebody else who died way too young. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's Rashida Phillips. She's the new executive director of the American Jazz Museum. Come back and give us an update on your progress, and we're wishing you the best of luck trying to do some good things there.
Thank you so much, and please remember to come on down and visit us. We're happy to have you.
Good place to go.
That's right.
Rashida Phillips, after a short break, we'll have a conversation about going from UMKC to Broadway. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If this hour of radio isn't enough to scratch your up-to-date itch, subscribe to my newsletter at kcur.org/Kraske. Get my observations on guests and topics delivered to your inbox each Monday. Signing up is easy. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow, ever since his college days, he's worked to help athletes of color make their voices heard. I speak with one of the most influential sports activists of the past 50 years. That's Harry Edwards. That's Friday on KCUR's Up to Date.
Siasa!
Shakira Wade went from the halls of UMKC to Broadway. She just completed a 2-year tour with The Lion King. That's the soundtrack from the original Broadway cast you're listening to now. That had her dancing and traveling all over the nation. Along the way, she developed a new respect for Broadway and all that goes into a show like The Lion King. But how do you get a part in a production as big and grand as something like The Lion King? We're about to find out. Shakira Wade joins us from St. Louis Public Radio. It's nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, you were on the road for 2 years. To what extent is it a relief to have that behind you?
It's kind of bittersweet.
I bet.
I'm excited to be back home and to reground and be with family. But I do miss traveling and being with my art family, being away from home and being able to be on stage every single day.
Tell us what you did in the show, Shakira, and how challenging it was.
Well, I was a dancer in the show, so I was in the zebra track.
Ah.
And what that means is my opening number for the Circle of Life, I start as a zebra. And then I have about 7 other changes that I make within the show. So I'm a zebra, a lioness, a hyena, a copa girl. And then we just have like our regular civilians that we play. And then is there 2 more things? Zebra,
yeah.
Lioness, hyena, copa girl, human.
Which one did you like the most?
The zebra and the lioness. I connected to those 2 the most.
Yeah. Hey, how challenging was it to do that show night after night?
Well, in the beginning, I was so excited. So it was the adrenaline rush.
I bet.
Just to be a part of a production of this magnitude. But after the, you know, months started hitting me and the staying at the hotels and just the pressure and the stress of the wear and tear from the puppets in the show, I started to feel it maybe like after a year mm-hmm. and a half, possibly. And then I was like, oh, okay, that's that road work they were telling me about. So it kind of started to pick up on my back and mm-hmm. and my body. I started to notice it a lot more.
It became a grind.
Yes.
Yeah.
It became a grind, and it became a point for me to dive deeper into my purpose within the show and being able to travel the world at
mm-hmm.
that time.
And what did you conclude from that? That deeper dive you just took?
Really impact and connection.
Mm-hmm.
Really being able to connect with different people in every city to kind of get a feel of the energy and the culture, the spirit of the cities. And then realizing that we're all connected no matter what. No matter how much we try to disconnect or judge or label, we're all connected.
How tough is it to keep your head in the game, you know, night after night after night like that?
I mean, I think attaching your purpose and your why helps you stay afloat during those dark times or those stressful moments because, you know, my purpose for doing this was greater than myself. I knew it was doing for my family. It's a part of my life mission. It's a stepping stone to the next place. So that really, like, anchored me,
mm-hmm.
even though you're human. So your flesh is going to be like, okay, we're tired, we're stressful. Thankfully, we can take off on days where our body's just like clocked out. But I really was anchored in God, really, and the joy of being able to do what I do coming from where I came from, because not that many people that I've experienced have been able to be a part of a show of this magnitude. So that really, like, kept me grateful.
I was going to say, how does the energy of the audience, you know, its enthusiasm affect you on stage? Because this show generates so much enthusiasm.
Oh, I love it. It's a conversation. The audience gives us energy and we give them energy. And it inspires you. To me, that's what motivates me to get through, feeling that connection that we just touched a life of somebody in the audience. That's what fueled me as well.
How did you even hear about the show to begin with, Shakira, and that the producers were looking for dancers?
Well, I was out living in New York, and I was auditioning, you know, doing the artist hustle, taking classes, learning, growing. And then 2 of my friends actually sent me the audition, and that's how I initially heard about it.
And you weren't that excited about it at first, right?
No,
you were a hard sell.
Yeah, you know, I'm from St. Louis, so, you know, I'm from that hard knock life. I love hip-hop culture. I love rawness. I love streetness. So I thought Broadway was cheesy. I didn't really have that much of an understanding of it, so I prejudged it, honestly.
Do you still think Broadway is cheesy?
I mean, there's moments, but within it, it has to be theatrical to connect, to express and connect with the audience, to get you to step outside of yourself as well as an artist.
So you came away from it, if I understand correctly, with sort of a new appreciation for what Broadway is all about.
Oh, absolutely.
Tell it's me not, about that, yeah.
I mean, it's a... First of all, you're being taken out of your life to go and connect and tell a story to a group of people, an audience. So being away from your family, you don't realize how much that impacts a person because they're your support system. They're your life force in a way. So people sacrifice that to go on the stage and perform. That's a huge, huge thing, as well as what you have to do to maintain your mind, your body, your spirit on the road. It can be a challenge if you don't have that support system from your family.
And then there's the whole idea of actually the effort that goes into staging a massive production like The Lion King. What did you take away from that?
I mean, you put greatness in, you get greatness out, really. Hmm. You put in that hard work. You manage everything, you make sure things are organized accordingly, then you have no choice but to get something great back.
You know, the tryouts were pretty intensive. About 300 girls tried out. How many actually made it?
There were, at the end of every audition, I did two. There were about seven of us.
Man.
And from that, it was like maybe 300 to 400 girls in each audition. And it was definitely intense. Like, you felt everybody's, like, energy and anxiety. But it ended up being four of us that joined the new company.
Why did Shakira Wade stand out so much in a crowd that large?
Because I was hungry, and I'm from St. Louis. And we have heart from St. Louis. Like, we have this passion, I feel, that is just so undeniable. And I was really channeling my struggle during the audition, because the story is about, you know, triumph and succeeding and overcoming.
Right.
So I really channeled my life at the auditioning. At the auditioning, I feel like they connected to that and they can feel it.
Hey, I was going to say, how did you prepare for the tryouts?
I mean, I feel like the work had already been done, honestly. Like, going to UMKC, putting in all, like, dancers work so hard. Like, every day, you know, as a student, going to class at 8 a.m., really becoming aware of your body, becoming aware of your practice in dance, your acting skills, your singing skills. Like, I stayed in class, and then I allowed myself time to actually reflect and let it sit, so that when I get presented with the opportunity to apply for a job, I would feel like I deserved it.
I'm visiting with Shakira Wade, who went from the halls of UMKC to a touring production on Broadway of The Lion King. You've said that the dancing part of the tryouts came pretty easily to you, but the singing was something else entirely. Why was the singing part so daunting?
I mean, it's daunting because I was a dancer. Mm-hmm. I only saw myself as a dancer.
And not a singer.
Exactly. And I've taken classes in, like, high school and glee club, and I know I could carry a tune, but I had never been presented with the opportunity to do it in front of people. So that was really what was scary about it.
At one point, you actually stopped your tryout and asked to start all over again. Some people might think that's a death sentence, but it wasn't for you. What happened there?
I mean, I had to live in my truth. I feel like we're human, and sometimes we forget that in life. Like, I make mistakes, I'm clumsy, I have moments, and I feel like that afforded me an opportunity to really connect with them, because they could tell I was nervous, I was shaking, my voice was like cracking, I couldn't get a note out. So I was like, let me pause, take a breath. Okay, I'm ready. And I got it out, and they were like, you have a lot of heart. And I was like, thank you. I know that was a mess.
So for you, that moment, it might have been a bad moment, turned into something pretty positive.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How would you describe the camaraderie of the company during those 2 years on the road?
It was an interesting journey. Joining it, it was just like we're getting thrown into this machine that's been going for so many years. And, you know, with something like that, you already have your system organized. And here we are, these new kids, fresh on the block, excited to be entering this new world. And we were just taking in everything that the cast was giving us because they opened with a performance. And to be surrounded around, first of all, so many African-American people at this caliber of a show, traveling the world doing this, I wasn't used to seeing that. So they opened up with the singing, and it just made me feel so comforted to find like that family connection. And I began to like form bonds with certain people in the show that have lasted and will last a very long time. And I've learned some valuable lessons about myself and how I should speak up when I'm going through things, how I should ask for help when I need it, because I was very, like, to myself. And it wasn't until towards the end of it where I really was like, I should have been talking to people more and letting them know what I'm going through. But it was a sense of we all are trying to figure this out together, so don't be afraid to ask for help if you need it.
I was going to say, really intensive experiences with other people like the one you just had, the bonds you form, and maybe in some cases the bonds that don't get formed are pretty powerful.
Absolutely, because a lot of some of the singers and performers in the show are from South Africa, which is amazing because, like, you know, as an African American, I always want to connect to people from the motherland and just see how they are to be, you know, birthed in Africa. So I thought that was an amazing thing to like feel them and hear the language and the different stories that they told us about what happens back home, how I can like find my relatives, because I'm into astrology. So I was like, oh, she's a Cancer like my mom. That same energy is popping up because I need to learn something from her, or she's trying to teach me something.
Right.
So I really like was observing it from that perspective and trying to like learn from them, but still also struggling with my own like insecurities of reaching out for help.
You know, I teach up at UMKC. I should point that out. But you were at the school from 2012 to 2015. How well did UMKC prepare you for life on Broadway?
Oh my gosh, so much preparation. Discipline is the number one thing, because you have to be disciplined as an artist, because nobody's going to stand over you to make sure you do your job. So they really taught me that I have to love what I'm doing. At the end of the day, you can give me a schedule, but it's up to me to show up every day and love and find the joy in what I'm doing. Because on the road, that's hard, because you literally don't have anybody. It's just you.
Mm-hmm.
So the discipline, the technique I learned, the essence and the energy of being just powerful and honing that and using that to like connect with the audience. I learned that from Deanna Hyatt. She would always say, essence, essence, give me essence. So she taught us to really like hone our power and not be afraid to like command the space and the stage with that. So I really channeled that through a lot of my puppet work, some of the animals that I played and portrayed.
Right. Hey, Shakira, real quickly, what's next for you? 10 seconds.
Music. I'm working on an album, so I'm just preparing that and doing as much as I can to connect to the community.
So you're going to sing now?
Yes, I'm actually a rapper, a singer, a poet, so I'm working on that.
That's Shakira Wade. She attended UMKC, then found herself in a touring production of The Lion King. Shakira, the best to you, and thanks so much for taking some time.
Thanks so much for having me. God bless.
Coming up, Brian and Spencer talking about cool stuff to do this weekend.
Todos están pendientes a ti.
Oh, Salvador Perez in the left field corner.
Haciendo
como
alguien más. Porque todos.
There goes Braun. Salvador got a good pitch to throw on, and it's not even close. He calls that one deep to left field, and the Royals have another two-run lead.
Yo te voy a buscar. Dile que tú eres mío.
Circles around, and then he makes a nifty play.
Brian McTavish and Spencer Hardwick are here to talk about some cool things to do this weekend. Brian follows and writes about pop culture. Spencer is the founder and curator of Wire KC Weekender. You know, this is a Chiefs time of year, but I'm hearing lots of baseball sounds
there.
What's up with that?
Well, you can blame the Royals for that. You know, this has to be, I know it's the very first Kansas City Royals Fan Fest, which takes place this weekend downtown at the convention
center. It's the first one?
No, it's the first one that's occurred in anticipation of a Super Bowl.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Everybody wants to talk about the Chiefs, including me and you and you. But anyway,
yes.
Baseball's right around the corner. It's KC Royals Fan Fest. Salvi's back.
Yeah, he is.
We're hearing the highlights of his 2018 baseball season. Now, due to injury, he had to sit out last season,
as we all know.
But he's back. Not only is he back, but starting on Friday at 4 o'clock on the main stage at the Royals Fan
Fest. This is amazing.
I know, it's amazing. He will be a full-fledged American citizen. That's right. You can witness Salvador Perez's naturalization ceremony.
Wow.
He will take the, quote, oath of allegiance.
Mm.
Kind of makes you realize what kind of pretty cool country we got here, right?
Yes.
We were just born into it, right?
Yeah.
He's going to be an American for official reasons, but...
What happens at Fan Fest?
Let me tell you. I walked right into that. dozens and dozens and dozens of players and former players and front office people and broadcasters. You can sit and listen to, or stand if you prefer, General Manager Dayton Moore, new manager Mike Matheny,
nice,
new Royals Chairman and CEO John Sherman, who you had in here not that long ago.
Yeah.
You'll get a chance to get lots of autographs. There's also lots of related activities, interactive stuff. You can actually take the kids and get on a little diamond as they do, you know,
mm-hmm,
and throw it as fast and as hard as you can and see if you might become a Royals player one of these days. It could happen.
It could happen to me.
It could happen to you.
Yeah.
Never too late.
That's FanFest this weekend at Bartle Hall, 2 to 9 on Friday, 11 to 7 on Saturday.
Four! Straight down the middle, it went straight down the middle, then it started to hook just a wee bit, and that's when my caddy lost sight of it. That little white pellet has never been found to this day.
We've gone from football to baseball, and now we're going to golf.
Golf, yes. So in these hyper politically charged times, there are two things I think that most Americans can agree on.
Yeah.
We like beer.
Mm-hmm.
And we love putt-putt golf.
Yes, we do.
No offense to this new Topgolf.
I love everyone loves it.
Looks really great. But putt-putt will always be America's true national pastime. So, Steve, you know, one of my favorite things are these hybrid events that combine two different things, whether it's a food or an activity that people aren't used to seeing together. Someone had the brilliant idea of doing a putt-putt pub crawl. This is the Brewer's Alley putt-putt pub crawl, where you can go from bar to bar, pub to pub, in a great bar spot around Kansas City. And there's going to be a golf hole, a miniature golf hole, at every pub.
Boy, there's a new idea.
Absolutely. So
yeah,
you're going to have a team of four. They're going to have rewards for all different kinds of achievements, whether it's the best shot. I think there's the best course design. I think it will all culminate at City Barrow, but it's just something different to get us in the mood for the Super Bowl.
Wow. Interesting. So that's this weekend.
Yes. Yeah,
wow.
This is Saturday, 12 p.m. to 4:30 p.m., starting at City Barrow. That's 18th and Holmes. Should be a fantastic time. So even if you're not super big, or you don't quite want to wait for the Masters, this might be the thing to do.
You're looking a little skeptical, wise one.
What will what will the putts look like at the end of the crawl?
That's a very good question.
If you can sink one at the end.
Tiger doesn't usually have a drink or two before he putts in the 18th green of the Masters.
Oh, well,
right?
When you put it that way. I'm okay then.
But he does afterward, I'm sure.
Yeah. I'm sure he does. Yeah.
God and country music, like whiskey and a prayer. Like Johnny Cash's arm round Billy Graham. God and country music, they both never really change. You find them when you need them, where you stand. There's always lost in the found, darkness in the eyes of the light. It's living in those small towns, in some church or back road honky tonk tonight.
Whoa. Boy, that's nice. That's George Strait.
It really doesn't get better than that.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. George Strait.
Straight. Oh, yeah, my. There you go.
Oh, okay. Get on Easy Street. Go see George Strait. King George of Country Music holds court. Two shows.
They call him the King George of Country Music?
They do. They also call him, what's the other nickname he has? Something like, what is it? It's King George. Oh, a King of Country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, George Jones was the old possum.
Ah.
Would you rather be the King of Country
or
the old possum?
No.
All right. So anyway, so two shows, Saturday and Sunday, Sprint Center. Okay. I'm almost speechless, but I better get going. God and Country Music, he sings here. He sings about how there's lost and the found in this dance between sin and salvation, right? He is the emblematic country crooner since at least the 1980s when he showed up as this neo-traditionalist mm-hmm. who spearheaded the return of old-fashioned country music ways over the poppier, slicker country music productions of previous years. He's got the hat. He's got the baritone. He scratches beneath the surface of heartache, but he rises, you guys. You with me? Mm. He rises to the giddy promise of a good time honky-tonk. Two shows weekend.
That's right.
Well, I got some more. His music is the sturdy stuff that speaks to the common soul of small-town meat and potatoes America. As if it needs to be said, it's straight from the heart this weekend.
This weekend.
At Sprint.
What's yours? What's up, Spencer?
So I have to admit, this is probably my favorite event of the weekend. This is definitely for the foodies around town. And this is called No Passport Required. So there's three things I get with this. No Passport Required is a new show that explores other cultures through the cuisine of America's thriving immigrant communities. At this special screening, you'll get to see special scenes from the newest season of No Passport Required. And then there will be a discussion led by none other than Danielle Lehman of the Open Belly Podcast. Now, if you're a foodie and this is a podcast, mm-hmm. listen closely to what I'm going to say next. If you are not on the Open Belly Podcast for Kansas City, exploring different cuisines around the city, you are doing something in life wrong.
Is
Open
that right?
Open Belly Podcast. She's going to be leading the discussion after No Passports Required. And then it wouldn't be a foodie event if there wasn't some delicious samples of food that you could take and eat right afterward. So wow. I get everything. I get a screening, I get a discussion led by a local podcaster, and then I get some delicious cuisine. We get often talk about the barbecue and things on the plaza, and those are fantastic restaurants. Also, focusing on cuisine from the immigrant community here in Kansas City is wonderful.
That sounds good. What do we have here?
Okay, we have the Chinese New Year celebration as they do every year at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. It's Sunday from 10 to 4, Sunday at the Nelson. Help ring in the year of the rat.
Wow.
I guess every animal,
every
critter gets its turn. Free, no ticket required. You can take part in the year of the rat. According to the Chinese horoscope, the rat, or mouse if you prefer, is the zodiac animal sign who will reign this year. Temporary tattoos, rat tattoos, so it's okay, Mom and Dad, don't worry, right? In addition to lots of family-friendly music and dance and other activities to mark the Lunar New Year, calligraphy demonstrations, paper lantern fun. Wait, I buried the lead. There's a yo-yo demonstration.
Okay. Mm. Oh, that'd be fun.
Oh, yeah.
And finally today.
Whiskey River, take my mind.
Let's talk whiskey, Spencer.
Yes, remember we talked about the Kentucky Hug a few weeks ago, that sensation you get from bourbon that coats your throat? Well, don't take this the wrong way, but I think that this is the Super Bowl of whiskey tasting in Kansas City this
really?
Weekend. The 2020 Kansas City Winter Whiskey Tasting Festival. It's going to have everything. Scotch, Irish, single malt, blend to bourbon and rye. Your taste buds will be in heaven as you sample dozens of amazing whiskey varieties.
Woo.
This is taking place at Brick and Mortar, 7425 Broadway.
Wow.
And this is happening... Oh, I don't have a time, so you have to check your local listings to see what the time is.
But out in Waldo, Brick and Mortar KC.
Exactly. Should
That's
be
Spencer
fantastic.
Hardwick, Brian McTavish with some fun stuff to do this weekend. Gentlemen, thanks very
Thank
much.
You.
Appreciate it.
Go Chiefs.
Tomorrow on the show, there are terminally ill patients receiving costly medical care that offers little benefit. Learn how doctors and their patients can better prepare for a quality end of life. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Engstrom. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.